Hi, this is Chuck Russell, director of The Blob, and you're watching Junk Food Cinema.
Hey, who the hell are these guys and who gave them a copy of my film?
Hey guys, it's Chuck Russell. I heard you were covering my movie, The Blob, for your Summer of 88 series, and I'm thrilled. It was a tough, wonderful shoot with some of the most ambitious physical effects, most of them full scale, no CGI, it's all the real thing. So I hope you guys enjoy it. And listen, by the way, Joe Lynch seems like a nice guy, but if you've seen his movie Mayhem, you might want to think twice about being locked in a studio with him. Just saying.
Beware of junk food, they cast their ass and do a bunch of silly things that you should not imitate because legally they don't want to get in trouble. It's junk food. Beware of junk food. Hey, everyone. I am super excited to be here today for a very special episode of Junk Food Cinema brought to you by anybody? Anybody? That's right. Film School Rejects. I love the soundboard so much. The weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, joined as per usual by my friend and co-host and novelist and screenwriter and Lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going, sir?
It's pretty exciting this week. We've got one of the main reasons I wanted to do Summer of 88, and we've got the perfect guest. The whole reason we have not done this movie yet over the years was not because we were saving it till today, but because we were saving it to do with this guest, because doing it without this guest would be just not right.
So wrong.
And we've got him. He's back again for his second visit to Junk Food Cinema. He's a director. He is a podcaster. You may know him from such films, his films as Everly and recently Mayhem. You may know him from the podcast. It's the Movie Crypt.
Oh, that warms my heart. Oh, well, and also a private of Megaforce.
And a private of Megaforce, Mr. Joe Lynch.
Woo-hoo, thank you, guys. Oh, my God. I am so thrilled to kind of be here. You guys look great, I guess. This is very weird that I'm not actually there, because the last time that I was there, this was at in Austin for South by Southwest, right after I had premiered Mayhem, which I had lost my voice. So if you ever wanted to hear, like Estelle Getty or something, it was B. Arthur, like, on the podcast, that was definitely me, whereas I love Argento's phenomena, monkeys with raises are great.
We tried to get Bea Arthur on the show, but we were told by her reps that she is dead.
Well, that's unfortunate. What is fortunate is that we are talking about arguably one of my favorite films, the film that made me want to make movies, and I do not say that lightly, and a movie that weirdly enough has come in and out of my life over and over again. Trust me, this is going to be a very long episode filled with tons of Stargroves, a plethora of sidebars. Hell, we might, Jürgen, pause now at least three or four times, because we're talking about one of my favorite movies.
There's also going to be a lot of beer involved. Let's not lie about that.
It's already there, my friends. It's already there.
It's entirely possible. And that movie, of course, is The Blob.
The Blob!
Cut to the trailer!
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a face, you could look it in the eye. If it had a body, you could shoot it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
I want that organism alive.
I think you pissed it off.
The Blob. Terror has no shape.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that, as does Meryl, who gets really upset if we don't make a pause between saying the name of the movie and letting him put in the trailer. So thank you for, you know the show so well, you know, like the inside baseball stuff, and that makes me happy.
I love that we have to give, you know, give Meryl just a little bit of time to put it in.
Yeah, just a little bit of time.
Let me just say, first off, can I just, look, here, I'm going to Jürgen pause now for a second, and this might be a Stargrove, so get ready with the soundboard.
Oh, I'm ready.
This movie, like we were saying before, means a lot to me. You guys are a huge part of my life, especially last year. I did a full junk food cinema binge where I thought I had listened to every episode. Oh, mama, have I did not. And I was going through a really rough summer, and you guys were definitely my, honestly, like, you were my therapy buddies. Like, it was so vital that you guys were in my life to have this discussion. I ended up kind of watching so many 80s action flicks last summer just because I just was either keeping up with the, you know, the previous summer. I think it started with Project X, where I'm like, I have to watch Project X again. And dear God, the waterworks. Oh my God.
And that movie's so
fucking good. And that, like, thus began this kind of summer of like hanging out with you guys kind of virtually. So to be here for this movie, it was one that I think even last year I'm going, they're going to do Summer of 88. And if those motherfuckers don't call me for either Die Hard or The Blob, I'm going to come to Austin. I'm going to burn every fucking porch I can find.
Joseph Daniel Lynch, did you just get real on us? Did you just break it down and give us a reason to get misty-eyed? Because I think you did. I think you did.
It's going
to
happen a lot in this episode because, like, this movie has shaped the kind of course of my life in so many different ways. It's come in and out of my life, whether, you know, it be the director or the writer or even some of the actors. Like, the weird connections I've had with this movie. And thank God it's a movie that I'm proud to say stands the test of time and is easily in the upper echelon of 80s horror movies, of 80s movies, of monster movies in general. Like, it's one that I don't think people know enough about, whether it's because of rights issues or just release and availability. But it's one that I think, with the help of, you know, podcasts like you guys, people are going to remember and people are going to at least rediscover or discover. I mean, I can keep going on.
Says the guy who cut out for
just
2 seconds.
Just the last two seconds, which made it hilarious that you came back in with, I could go on. Because we're sitting here thinking, man, you're...
God damn it. Well, let's jump into this fucking movie. Seriously.
Let's do it. Enough standing on ceremony. Except I do want to say one more thing. At Junk Food Cinema on Twitter, patreon.com. Hold on. Patreon.
Come on, Brian.
I was waiting for that.
Dot memory loss.
And of course, Denver Comic Con, which as of this recording, I think will be us this week.
Oh, we're doing the housekeeping part. Sweet.
On Friday at 8 o'clock, we will be doing a live Monster Squad episode with Ryan Lambert and Andre Gower live in person on the show. So I'm super excited for that. So if you're going to Denver Comic Con, make sure to add that to your schedule. I also want to say, as it's probably a moot point at this point, but we will probably be having a few technical hiccups as we record remotely with Joe, so please just bear with us. But anyway, yes.
If anything, blame Meryl. It's fine.
Yeah, I intend to.
It's more than just recording for Joe. Let's be straightforward here. We are kind of recording in the shambles of my new house.
Yeah, we're in Cargill's brand new house.
So essentially, wait. We're on beta testing mode for junk food
for JFC. 2.0.
This is crazy.
And probably determining.
Someone get a fucking champagne bottle. We should be, you know.
I'm halfway there.
We're rocking the beers.
So that's okay, the champagne of beers is beer.
Hey, hey guys. Hey. Where were you August 5th, 1988?
I was in Tucson, Arizona. And I was not able to go see this in a theater. It was a big deal because the first rated R movie, I didn't talk about this earlier, but the first rated R movie I was allowed to see in a theater on my own was Die Hard. And I saw that three times in a theater that summer, but my parents were still very picky about what I went to. And they were fine with Die Hard, but The Blob was right out. And it was exactly – which is so awesome because that's exactly a subplot of the movie, in fact. But I ended up catching this on video shortly thereafter.
At 3:10 p.m. at Brookhaven Multiplex on August 5th, 1988, young Joe Lynch's life changed forever. No, seriously, like I distinctly remember seeing this movie. Up until that point, I either wanted to be an actor or a makeup effects guy. So I basically wanted to be Tom Savini. But I remember seeing this movie, and this was in the era of the Fango days, where you would open up these pages and you would see, you know, at least 2 to 3 articles about whatever movie was coming out. And in this case, it was The Blob. The articles about The Blob came out way early in like June. So you're looking at these like graphic, disgusting images and you're going, what the fuck is this movie? So to me, this was, I was going in and going, this is just Fango porn. When I left that theater, I had basically kind of figured out what a director does just by watching the film. Because, you know, again, I went in going like, I want to watch this for the effects, or I want to watch this for, you know, the acting or whatever, and see like, how do you scream well when a giant blob monster is coming after you? But then seeing how, now this was a 3 o'clock show on a Friday, it was packed. And at the time, like my mom would be the one who would take us to a lot of these movies. This was like right before I started sneaking into movies. So my mom, who's a big horror movie fan, was like, oh, let's go to see The Blob. It sounds wonderful. So we all went, and I remember sitting there watching the audience at key pivotal moments scream and jump and like cathartically laugh and go, oh shit. And very rarely do we even see that. A few days ago when I saw Hereditary, where there was people who were like really fucked up over that movie. And to watch how this movie was affecting all the people in that crowd, and they were doing it through cinematography and editing and makeup effects and acting and music and all these things coming together. And I remember like just asking my mom, like, so the director's the guy that kind of like works with all those people? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to be the guy that gets to talk to the guy with the mullet and to be able to, you know, sit there with the people who have the silk stockings with the gravy in it, and to be able to sit with the editor and know exactly where to cut when the blob comes into the telephone booth. For years, I broke this movie down, whether it was on HBO or it was on VHS, and learned the craft of movie making through The Blob. And, you know, and we all have those movies too, where it's like, we study them and we love them, and then you revisit them years later or whatever, and you go, like recently, and I'm just going to confess this. I know I'm going to get a lot of shit from this, but for me, rewatching Flash Gordon, it doesn't have the same luster as it did when I was a little kid, partially because when you get better and better in your fidelity, your special effects look worse and worse. When you watch The Blob on HD, it's on like iTunes now, or you watch it on streaming, or, you know, there used to be a DVD Blu-ray. The quality of the effects in that movie still look great. Like there's a moment in the movie. I'm sorry if I'm hijacking this, guys. I'm really sorry, but I only get one chance.
No, we kind of brought you in for that because we didn't want to do anything this week.
Well, good. So sit back, crack another fucking beer open, and let me fucking go to work here. But like,
on it.
There's a moment in the movie where you know, the infamous sink scene, right? Which, if you look at it closely, it outrafts the raft from Creepshow 2. I'm fucking throwing the gauntlet. Like,
no, I 100% agree.
Do you guys remember the shot where it's like inside the sink, and it's like, you know, the one hand's going out and the other foot with the tennis shoe is like sticking out and everything. Mm-hmm. And you see Shawnee Smith and Kevin Dillon in the background. I never noticed that's an optical shot. And, you know, the feet and everything, they get sucked in. And usually when you see an optical shot done from like the 70s or 80s, you know, that's a shot that hasn't been done CG. It's been composited using old school optical effects. So it's a generation of a generation of a generation a lot of times. And that's why things look grittier. There's hair on it and shit. And there's a fair amount of them in this movie. You know, not going to lie, there's a few that are a little egregious. But back in the day, they were kind of state of the art. But this one sync shot, I'd seen this movie a million times and never realized that that shot, which I always looked live, was a process shot. It was an optical shot, because right after those feet and the tennis shoes get sucked in, you have like the strawberry ice cream version of the blob that shoots upwards towards the ceiling, which the only way that they'd be able to do that is do it, you know, optically with like miniatures or whatever. And that kind of craftsmanship and that kind of knowledge of how to goose the audience and really make them feel the effects that are going on and feel the tangibility of what the blob is, it's impeccable. And this is Chuck Russell's second movie, you know, it would be his second movie because before that,
it's a second directorial film. It's the third film we've talked about, and we talked about his films in order.
Well, keep going. You got a few more, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. Well, we talked about Dreamscape, which he wrote. And then of course we did A Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warriors, which he directed. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on all of this about the effects, except that anything that involves a blue screen, just most of it doesn't work. Like,
yeah, I don't disagree with you. There's a couple moments where it looks like they just said to Kevin Dillon, just run in front, shake your mullet, and just run out again. You'll be fine. You'll be fine, babe.
The sequence you were talking about, there's this, there's a quick cut. Like, it is just, it's
the
a
underhead
cut.
Shot of the thing, of the blob running. Oh, it's
of
it's
them
bad,
running
baby.
And the thing crawling across the ceiling. It just comes out of nowhere, and it's kind of like, oh. But the thing is that the blob looks so cool, and this movie is 30 years old. So at the time, that looked awesome.
The design of the blob is so integral in this iteration, because you know, when we were growing up, before the remake of the blob was a joke. You know, at least for my generation, it was like, oh, the movie that's on at seven, you know, on Saturdays at 11 o'clock on WPIX, where it's just the jellies squirting out of the movie theater and Steve McQueen, not so cool Steve McQueen, was in it. It's a gas. It's totally fine. But you look at the lineage behind it and the history and the culture shock that it had when that movie came out. I mean, that movie was a product of its time. You know, the red color being, you know, small town America's getting besieged by the red enemy. It's like, it's all right there. Whereas in the 80s, the look of the blob to me was perfect, because it was a culmination of the scaring of viral warfare. It was the fear of AIDS. You know, it was the fear of tumors. It had a much more body horror Cronenbergian sensibility, and even just the look of it, the pinkness of it, it feels like fleshy, and it could not have been a better design for the creature. Where, you know, and the fact that it's not just, like today, I hate to say it, and I'm sure we'll get to that, but when the CG remake happens, it's going to be all VFX. There's going to be barely any practical effects. Whereas watching this thing, I just watched it again today, and between the practical effects, the latex tendrils and the gravy bags of silk and the miniatures and all the different, it's like seven different effects disciplines are all brought together to create this creature, whereas now it would be done with maybe three different programs. But the amount of like tangible work that goes into that, it's like you can't not watch it and appreciate it on so many levels.
And you know what? It's funny you mentioned remake, because we should probably dip our toe into this a little bit.
I want to go way the hell back, so just allow me to.
There it is. Yes,
one of many. To answer the question you asked about 15 minutes ago, Joe, in 1988, Brian was very, and for anyone else who, like me, was very anxious about starting pre-K.
Oh, God damn it. Because
that's where I was in 1988.
Old man Joe Lynch.
Let's talk a little bit about what this movie actually is in terms of plot, because I don't think we've actually talked about the plot yet.
We haven't even mentioned who co-wrote this thing. We haven't mentioned the cast.
No.
We've just talked about practical effects for a while, because fuck you, Brian. That's what we're doing today.
And that's totally fine. Just throw my plan right out the window.
Wait, you
I'm
had a
fine
plan?
Whatever. Hey, I'm not freaking out at all.
Hold on. If there was a plan, we would be getting into the plot 40 minutes in. Boys, I listened to the show.
This was the plan. You don't understand. This is some Dirty Dozen shit where we had a plan and then it all goes to shit and like three of us walk out.
Well, and this, which is good because there's three of us in the room. So I think our odds are pretty good.
There we go.
So The Blob. Yes, this is a remake. This is, in my opinion, one of the greatest horror remakes of all time, partially because of something Joe has already touched upon, which is that the Red Scare, which is translated literally in the first Blob of the 50s with a red gelatinous monster that consumes and assimilates people, is very much the Red Scare of the Cold War. It's amazing, though, that they were able to remake it almost 30 years later and are still in 1988. It's coming to a close, but are in the grip of the Cold War, but adding, of course, all the elements that Joe mentioned. So it's interesting that they're able to update and still have a lot of the same subtext, which is fascinating. But this is a movie about a meteorite that crashes in a town near Arborville, California, which is first discovered as, this is what I love about 80s horror, it's always a homeless person or some kind of transient or somebody living on the fringe that's the first to know that there is a threat. I mean, it's the crazy Joe, no, Joe is our guest. I'm trying to remember the name now, and it's Friday the 13th. Joe, help me out. It's got a death curse.
Oh, there's crazy old man in this movie for sure.
But so it's discovered first by a crazy old man, and of course,
Billy Beck. Yep.
Crazy old man is discovered by Kevin Dillon with, wow, just that hair. Let's talk about that. We could do a whole podcast on just that hair.
There's some serious drama there.
Well, first of all, he goes full Stamos, and he goes full Stamos before Stamos went full Stamos.
I'm sorry, who?
Stamos. He's got the leather jacket. He's got the beautiful mullet. He is strutting around. He does a walk that is halfway between Saturday Night Fever and 1990 Bronx Warriors.
Yes, I was hoping you were going to say trash. I was so hoping you were going to say trash.
It's so fucking cool and douchey at the same time. It's glorious.
I call that cushy.
But, you know, like, what I love about that opening, first off, this movie is a master at the misdirect, because that opening scene where the entire town is just a ghost, it's a ghost town, and then it takes the football game to bring us into this world and makes you realize how small this town is. And the way that they use, all right, they set up the football, they set up a couple characters there, but then they set up Brian, the town rogue, the town rebel, and the intercutting between the bridge, very nice, the intercutting between the bridge and the fans cheering him on. It's like, it's a fantastic device that makes us root for this asshole, because let's be honest, he doesn't change much throughout the movie. The only thing that he gets an arc on is he doesn't make the bridge here, and spoiler alert, he makes the bridge later on. He's still pretty much the same douche.
No, I would strongly disagree, because he's the guy who doesn't care about anybody else, who ends up risking his life to go back for someone.
It's a save the cat, like, almost literally.
I will say, here's one of the interesting things I find about this film conceptually is, I mean, we haven't mentioned it yet. We mentioned that Chuck Russell directed it. He co-wrote it.
Which, by the way, we need to give a special thank you to both Chuck and Joe for arranging the fact that the first voice you heard this week was Chuck Russell.
So the person who co-wrote it with him was Frank Darabont. Ooh. And Frank Darabont.
Sorry about that one. Sorry.
Good. Let's get into it. But the thing is that these guys know their 50s cinema. They know their B movies. They know very much where the original Blob came from. And what's interesting about this film is that they hit all of the classic 50s archetypes of these kind of monster movies. So you've got your leather jacket wearing rebel without a cause. You've got your cheerleader. You've got your football player. You got your local town sheriff. You got your scientist. You've got your overbearing military. And they subvert those in wonderful ways.
Yeah.
For one thing, this film is so fucking progressive in the fact that the only character who has their shit together is the cheerleader.
Yep.
And nobody ever mentions, there's a moment in the movie movie where her dad grabs her and says, "You stay here. We'll go take care of this." And I just, every time I see it, I yell out, "Motherfucker, she's the only one getting anything right in this goddamn movie. Let her keep doing it.
Everyone gives so much precedent to Ripley from Aliens, but Shawnee Smith, in, by the time you get to the end, when she's on that snowmaker thing and she's shooting that M16, she earns that badassness. I'm not taking away from Ripley at all, but
no,
she's amazing in this.
She was. She is, for guys of a certain age, you and me in particular, Joe, Shawnee Smith was kind of the embodiment of that strong, super hot teenage girl.
Between that and Harry Crumb and Summer School, she was like, oh, she was a girlfriend for a good 2 years.
Oh, yeah, easily. In fact, so much so that when I was watching, I remember seeing Armageddon for the first time, and she has her cameo. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's Shawnee Smith. And my friends just turned to me, and they're like, who? I'm like, fuck you.
Yeah, really.
But yeah, so this is – so all of these archetypes are here, but they're all wonderfully subverted. The sheriff is a good dude. The rebel without a cause ends up teaming up with the deputy who hates him in the best way. The high school jock is the first one to go. The scientist is actually the crazy guy, and the military guy is the guy that has his shit together. Like, it is a pure subversion of everything 50s B movies held as cliches, turned on its ear in the best possible way.
And I should restate that this movie doesn't open where I said it opens, with the meteorite. It actually opens with what I think is so great about The Blob, is that they establish middle America in a way that doesn't make you hate middle America. Like, you watch, like, literally the Friday football game. You see, you're introduced to the quarterback who you don't hate. You're introduced to the cheerleader you don't hate. Like, and they do such a good job of establishing how lived in this town is that you feel like by the time the inciting incident happens that you live there too. And also, just going to throw this out there, Varsity Blues totally rips off a shot from the beginning of this movie.
Oh, big time.
Yes, it does.
1,000% does. I guess he's a receiver, but he gets tackled and goes directly into the table full of Gatorade cups in slow motion. And I was like, if they start playing My Hero by the Foo Fighters right now.
Or Thunderstruck.
Super deja vu. So by the time the meteor actually hits, we're introduced to all these people that Chuck Russell, with his magical swinging golden balls, will kill so many of them by the time this movie is over.
So gruesomely. And so awfully.
Yeah.
Nobody gets an easy death in this movie.
No.
Like, they're, right from our, we get that horrible death of the hobo, followed up by Paul's death, where Shawnee Smith's trying to pull him out. Meg's trying to pull him out of the blob and only gets his arm.
Jesus Christ.
Did you guys know that when they first filmed that, they didn't tell Shawnee Smith that Donovan Leitch was going to be under there for the first stage, because they did that in three stages. So the first stage, when she first runs in, that is her actual reaction to him freaking out under piles of blob. Like, that... that's up there with, like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind methody directing shit right there.
That's pretty nuts, but I will argue that this is something I really noticed on this viewing. Shawnee Smith does such an amazing job of portraying just sheer horror. Like, she legitimately looks, like, stomach-queasingly terrified through so many scenes in this movie. And that shot in particular, and that makes sense. That's like the Goonies, where they don't let the kids see the ship until they're doing the shot.
Directing. There's another moment in that very moment where Donovan Leitch, and all of a sudden now the blob kind of has the same properties as the alien in Aliens, where they're bleeding blood and everything, or their blood is very acidic, which I think is a great stakes raiser. But when the blob kills Donovan Leitch, where it jumps on him, there's no music. If you watch the movie again, watch how there's no music whatsoever. So when she runs in, it's almost like an anti-drama moment, which makes it feel real when she comes in. I know it's such a weird little minutia moment, but in a scene when you would expect there to be like a dun 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 dun, and there's nothing, it shows, and this movie does it many times, it shows that this movie is not fucking around. The stakes are real, and the blob will kill anyone. Anyone is a possible victim. And again, like, you know, the movie's telling us mathematically based on structure that Donovan Leitch is our guy. He's going to be the dude who's going to ride us out into the sunset. And when he's ripped from us, like being in the theater and people going like, oh, no, because the movie was telling us one thing and just ripped out the carpet from underneath.
It's exactly like the original Nightmare on Elm Street where
Psycho.
Yeah, where they do that. Well, except that Nightmare on Elm Street did the same thing that The Blob does, which is we're introduced to a character and then we spend time with that character and another character. So it feels like we're following him when really we were just introduced to him and we're following her. Like there's only one or two moments in the original Nightmare on Elm Street where you're not with Nancy in the beginning of the movie. So it feels very much like it's not her movie until I'm blanking on her name, dies. And then you're like, oh shit, it's Nancy's movie. But when you rewatch the movie, Nancy's almost always there. Yeah. And that's how this is, where we get Shawnee Smith comes in as the love interest. And it turns out, no, that's just how we met our protagonist.
Yeah.
Do you
think the football player is going to be the protagonist? And then, oh no, must be the season of the switch.
I will say though,
which is because Donovan Leitch is Donovan's son. That was a
Yeah.
Anyway. Battle of the protagonists ends quickly.
Yeah, so I will mention this. This is my one gripe about the movie, because I only have one.
I will fight you.
You're welcome to, but my one gripe of the movie is something that you just said, Joe, in which anybody is up for grabs. The blob will eat anyone, except clearly he doesn't want to eat Shawnee Smith, because there's so many times the blob should have killed her and just goes like 30 seconds slower than it does with anyone else.
I feel like the blob, there's modus operandi with the blob, because I mean, there's a point where Del Close, who plays the priest, the great Del Close.
By the way, how good is he in this movie? Holy shit.
This movie is a wealth of supporting characters that will tear the roof off of any movie. But like, there's that moment when Del Close is walking home, you know, he's playing the priest. He's got a little nip of grandma's cough syrup, nice little touch. And the blob is 5 fucking feet away from him and just decides to just slink into the sewers. Doesn't kill him. But then later on, you know, the prophet, this was all part of a prophecy, and realize that like maybe the blob is smarter than we think. And that's the thing that, you know, I would love to open up to you guys and to everybody, is that the one thing that never really gets spoken about when it comes to the blob is how intelligent the sentient being is. Because in the first one, it's just, you know, it's just fucking killer alien jelly. In this one, it seems to have a more discernible palate, or it seems to have, you know, selective victiming. I'm very curious to wonder, like, how intelligent do we as viewers put on the blob? Because it is a killing machine, it, you know, and I think that's part of the allure of it being so terrifying, is that it doesn't reason. It can't be reasoned with. But how intelligent or lack thereof is this thing?
No, you're right. It does have a certain amount of sentience. And of course, the big twist of the movie that they pull away from the original is that this is not an alien being at all. It's, in fact, government made.
Biowarfare! How fucking great is that?
It wasn't a meteorite. It was an American satellite. And this biowarfare mutated in space under the cosmic radiation. And the growth of it set the mass off, spiraled the thing out of control, and it came down. And the government is there to contain it after a little light testing of letting it munch on some people.
Yeah, which I think is part of the selectiveness of how the blob operates. But I think that spares Shawnee Smith so that she can quote Lucas and Spielberg throughout the entire movie. My favorite moments of her in this movie are when she's like full on going Princess Leia and telling Kevin Dillon, like, take care of yourself. I guess that's what you're best at. Literally what she says to him. And then later when she's about to blow up the blob and says a basically derivative of smile, you son of a bitch. And this is where I love Chuck Russell, because any other movie she would have done that and then like thrown the bomb and jumped off the truck and everything would be fine. She tries to jump off the truck, her shoe gets stuck, and she face plants into the side of the truck and is just dangling there waiting for the bomb to go off.
Such a human moment. Like, and
so human.
That's the thing that I think elevates her, and I think elevates a lot of the other characters, is there are these human moments, like when you have the Mexican standoff, and Emil from RoboCop, who you know should be pointing his gun one way, ends up pointing his gun the other way at some points. Like, the character's choices in this film, almost as a comment to the movie theater scene when they end up watching, what was it, Power Tool Massacre. It's like, yeah, of course, those characters are going to make stupid decisions like, hey, what's that guy doing up there in the bushes? It's late at night. Where I remember watching this movie, and again, another reason why I connected so much to it, is that it felt like the characters were doing the things that they should be doing, not the things that are only going to propel the plot forward. Or if the characters who survived are doing that, the ones who die are the ones who are like, oh yeah, let's go down that hallway right there, or let's go check out that doctor's office.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was actually my first exposure to this movie, is that scene in the movie theater where he's the asshole's talking, and then the kid turns around and tells him to be quiet, and the blob has sucked him up, because that was an Alamo Drafthouse don't talk PSA.
It still is.
So that literally was my first exposure to this movie, and it forced me to seek it out and watch it, along with the original, which, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the effects.
I need to pause you right there.
Jürgen, pause now.
Because there's a small little movie detail. The first time I ever noticed it was last night. But of course, that scene, of course, is you're gonna love this. He hot curls her to death. If you watch it early in the film, when Kevin Dillon stops by the movie theater when the Jeffrey DeMunn, the sheriff, pulls up,
another Darabont alum.
Yep.
Yeah, another Darabont alum. He's standing there next to the poster for the massacre, and the girl on you see the guy in the background, and the girl on the front has her hair all fucked up and splayed out. So there's actually an image on the poster of the girl who gets hot curled to death.
That's amazing.
And I find that really funny.
It was funny because, like, watching the movie again just for like the little details, there are things like that, like how the, you know, Kevin Dillon's best friend, talks about, how snow isn't coming around, and all these like little details. And, you know, Garden Tool Massacre ends up becoming, you know, a major plot point. And even like there's that moment when you're watching that movie and it feels like Darabont and Russell are going, yeah, you guys like your slasher movies. We're going to give you a monster movie, and it's going to be even better. That whole scene is designed to kind of like strip the slasher movie from its gauntlet at that time.
Well, and at the same time, it's a very on point message about what was going wrong in horror cinema at the time, because when this movie was made, I mean, this is we're talking, this is what, the summer of Friday 8?
New Blood. Yeah. No, this was the summer of New Blood.
Friday 7.
No.
No, no, it is. 88 was the...
Yeah, 89 was
Takes Manhattan. 88 was Friday the 13th, The New Blood. So that's... right? Joe, come on. Help me out on this.
No, that sounds right.
Because we covered it. We covered that movie outside of a summer series, so sometimes I get a little confused. But I know it wasn't 89, because 89 was...
No, it was 88.
And here's how I know that...
No.
Am I right? Checking the IMDb? We're checking the IMDb.
Yes.
But I know
I don't need to check IMDb.
I should know this by now, but 89 was definitely Takes Manhattan, because when he walks through Manhattan, there's a poster for fucking Tim Burton's Batman that I remember seeing.
That's true.
But anyway, what the fuck was I talking? Oh yeah. So the slasher movies at the time, sending it up like that is so fucking fantastic. And I love the fact that it's one of my go-to geek out moments is when I see movie theaters in movies from the 80s, because I grew up in a time where the multiplex was already a thing. Like, these little movie houses that are depicted in these movies that, you know, guys like Joe and Cargill actually got to go to on the reg don't exist by the time I'm going to the movies. So I geek out so hard seeing 80s movies where people are going to the movies or walking around 42nd Street and all the marquees. And there's so many great little details in that.
And
we totally took advantage of that time where, you know, you get a bunch of people together in a communal experience and then put them through the ringer. You know, we don't have that as much anymore.
No, and the other thing is that what was interesting about that time in those type of movie theaters is if you wanted to see a movie on Friday night, you saw what was playing. There was none of this, hey, let's buy tickets in advance for this thing we want. You saw what was playing. So if it was Garden Tool Massacre, it's like, do I want to see a horror movie? Well, it's like, baby, do you want to go to a movie on Friday? All right, let's go see Garden Tool Massacre. Like, that was your fucking choice, unless you lived in a big city, at which point you could go to a movie theater that had 4, 6, or maybe 8.
Yeah. And I want to go back for just a second, though, related to the Friday the 13th movies. And we've mentioned him already in this film, playing Deputy Briggs. Paul McCrae from RoboCop, who is a sheriff's deputy.
I like it!
He's a sheriff's deputy who gets folded in half backwards, not unlike the sheriff in Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. However, how the fuck is he the only person who gets killed and doesn't get melted by the blob when a year earlier he was melted by toxic waste in RoboCop?
Maybe it
oh,
was
actually,
his...
no, you know what? It's this is true. He went up to Chuck on set and said, yeah, the whole melting thing kind of did it. And he said, all right, you know, we'll just fold you in half. And then he went, oh, you know, Friday 6th. And then he went, oh, fuck you, just get in your spot and we're just going to shoot this thing.
Wait, is that a real story or are you just fucking with not. God damn it. See, look, the thing to understand about having Joe on this episode is that one of my favorite episodes of It's the Movie Crypt.
I love when you guys do it. That's the best.
Is the episode where you interview Chuck Russell, because it's the episode where I realized it was worth a damn. So I now that I like the podcast because of that episode.
Oh, thanks.
I was really happy to have you on this and share your anecdotes. But if you're just going to fucking make shit up, you might as well be me.
No, like, no. All right, you know what? I'm going to give you. No, look. All right.
Oh wait, no. You know what? I'm gonna drop the hammer down on our guest for a moment, while also dropping the hammer down on you at the same time. There is a reason why Joe is on this episode, and it's not just because he is a Blob super fan. It is also because for a period of time he almost remade it.
Yes, that is very true.
So you have spent so much time deeply invested in this particular property and in the concept of doing this particular movie justice, because as we talked about several years ago, this was a movie that you were planning on remaking the 88 and tying it into the 88 and having nothing to do with the 58.
Joe, yeah. Tell us about it.
Okay, so funny enough, I wrote a sequel to The Blob in 1988. I was so blown away by this movie that I wrote a 10-page outline. I didn't know it was called an outline at the time. I just went like, this is probably some kind of scribbity-doo thing. They'll just shoot this. It'll be fine.
Blob 2, the electric blobaloo.
That was actually one of the options for the subtitle. I wrote because, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie yet, then you know that Del Close at the end of the film is holding that little blobette or whatever, that dollop of blob, that blollop, if you will.
blollop.
I'm sorry. Oh, man. I'm on the fourth beer at this point, so no holds barred. But I love the concept of how the movie gives the blob rules. You know, like obviously there's the there's the obvious one with it's susceptible to cold. But if you look, you know, very closely, when it gets towards metal, it kind of cauterizes metal or it rusts metal, but it can't break metal. So I had written this whole thing about how when we catch up with the priest from the previous film, he's on his kind of road show and he's now keeping the blob in a bathtub. And of course it gets out. And it goes to that warehouse that the guy at the end is, everybody, let's scoop up this blob and get it to the ice house, and works its way to that little area, infects that whole, icy blob configuration, and all hell breaks loose. Let me just be honest here. And I didn't get past page 8 in terms of the first act, but that was the setup. So I had been wanting to make any iteration of the blob, forever. So cut to a couple of years ago, someone who owned the rights to the Blob remake at that point had contacted me or heard that I was a big fan of it and just said, we would love to hear your take. They had a script already. So when I read the script, and I don't want to give anything away because there are things in it that made me go, you know what? All right, fuck it. You know, this is this is a really cool idea. So I fucking fought hard for this thing because, again, I do think that the blob, the thematics of the blob and what the blob represents as a monster movie, the blob as a movie or as a story kind of comes in waves, and it came at the perfect time in the 80s. It obviously it was conceived in the 50s, but, you know, came at the perfect time in the 80s, not just in the effects boom, but just in the monster boom and the horror boom at the time. Didn't cause a lot of waves, but it, obviously we're talking about it today, so it made a ripple. And I just feel like right now, you know, and they've been teasing doing a Blob remake for, God, 10, 15 years. Like Rob Zombie was going to do a version at one point. But every time they announced it, I just got like bummed until I got the call. And I was like, oh my fucking God. And they had a script. So I read the script, and again, there were elements in it that made me really excited, including how it actually ties into the previous Blob. And I thought that, you know, sorry, I'm probably foregoing some bullshit NDA or what have you, but that was one thing at the time in that script that got me really excited and made me go, you know what? It got to the point where I actually called Chuck Russell up, who I had met at one of the Masters of Horror dinners. And while everybody else was like, you know, hobnobbing and stuff, I just had to beeline over to him and say, you got to tell me everything about the Blob. And we became very fast friends. So I called him up and basically asked his permission and said, look, I really want to do this. And I don't know if you're involved at all. I was praying that he was, but he wasn't. But I would love to do this. And here are some of my ideas and everything. And he goes, look, if you can get the job, you got my fucking vote. You know, it's like, I'm in. But unfortunately, at the very last moment, and I'm sure, you know, there's other sides of the story, but what I was told was at the very last moment when, and this was in between Everly and Mayhem. So I wasn't in director's jail. I was kind of in like a conjugal visit area in the industry at that point. But they had to do kind of like a foreign sales check. And it was down to me and this other director. And when they ran those numbers, I clearly did not have the same foreign sales returns that this other director, who will not be named, but you have definitely covered him on Junk Food Cinema, I think many times actually in the past. But his numbers were better than mine, and he got the job. Now, I you know what? I bet you can probably find it on IMDb, but I will not say his fucking name, so fuck him. But let's just say that I don't think he's going to come with the same reverence to the Blob that I would. But part of my pitch, and you know what? This might be the reason why I didn't get the job. Who knows? Because to bring it all back to the 88 Blob, part of the reason why I think we appreciate this movie the way we do is there is tangible craftsmanship in this movie. You know, the acting, sure. The Mark Irwin, Mark Irwin's DP work, you know, he did I Come in Peace and Scream and all of, you know, Cronenberg's early stuff is fantastic. But the creature effects in this film are as intricate, as complex, and as successful as Rob Bottin's work in The Thing. I will go, there's that scene with the projectionist, the tapestry of blob that is like hanging over that poor fucking projectionist. That's like that, what is that? Remember in Devil's Advocate, that sculpture that they got sued over? It was like the ex Nihilo or something like that. Where it's like all these people, this like tapestry of people. That's what that fucking thing looked like. And again, as a kid from the 80s who grew up in Fango, where they would take stills of this and you would just sit there and pore over these shots of Tin Can Man, who's like half a person who looks like macaroni and cheese. I can't watch that scene now and not think about macaroni and cheese for some reason. that weird projection room tapestry. It's like there is so much work that goes into that. I would be remiss, and take a drink, Junkions, because I said remiss, and you know that comes up four times. Lyle Conway and Tony Gardner, the guys who did the effects. Lyle Conway did the blob effects, and Tony Gardner did the makeup effects. And we know Tony from the Chucky movies and Darkman and stuff. Their work in this film is career defining. It really is. It's just, but I don't know if it's maybe the fact that when you say career defining work, in the remake of The Blob. I don't know if that maybe that's a disconnect or whatever, but this is the sort of monster movie that we've wanted for so long and we haven't had for so long. And again, like, it, you know, if the remake ever happens, God bless it. I will definitely be there to see it, probably with a big heart. But my worry is that it won't have the same effect that it did when I was in that theater in August, watching how it scared me, but also how I was just amazed by how it was a symbiosis of cinematography and editing and music and puppetry and optical effects and, you know, blob wrangling that all came together to make a fucking mushy piece of globby jello piece shit scary. Like, yeah. That blows me away.
Yeah.
So here's let's take a short trip to the sidebar.
Sidebar.
I would like to ask you guys, what is the single most disturbing shot in this movie to you? What's the one that haunts your dreams?
The little kid popping up out of the water after he's been taken by the blob, which, by the way, again, the balls on this movie. And I want to say this, Joe, about what you were saying before. You pitching...
Wait, you're taking a sidebar in the sidebar?
Yeah,
sideception.
You pitching the idea for your blob to those involved with the blob in 88 reminds me of the fact that Chuck Russell sought out Jack Harris, who produced the original Blob, yes, to pitch him the idea. Like, you guys are such kindred spirits on that. And I also wanted to just mention, you said something about Mark Irwin. Yes, absolutely a frequent collaborator with Cronenberg, which makes sense because this is also a body horror movie from start to finish, but is also the reason that he was unavailable to shoot Dead Ringers was really? Because he was working on the Blob.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Well, I mean, hey, can't win them all. but
6-1. Yeah. In my book, lateral move. I'm just going to say
it. I would agree with you there. When you were talking about what were you talking about?
Well, I had asked.
I'm sorry.
You guys,
go back to your sidebar. Sorry,
I was asking
which sidebar
you guys
are we at, boys?
The most disturbing shot, the shot that haunts your dreams.
I would have to. I would also. I hate to be a cliche, but I would say that the moment when Eddie, the little kid, gets killed, because again, and weirdly, depending on the version that you see, there's two different versions of that death scene that are out there. There's one version where he's supposedly like less melted and shit, and then there's one that was like on a TV version or whatever that was more melted. I've never seen the difference version. I gotta seek it out a little more. But at that time, killing kids was still a taboo, you know. But then you have fucking Maximum Overdrive comes along, and this movie comes along, and they up the stakes again by making you realize that your normal movie tropes are not safe. The only thing that's missing from this movie is, you know, a dog falling into the blob and it burping.
They don't kill a dog in this movie.
They don't.
No, they don't.
Thank Christ. No. I'm disturbed by a different shot. There's another shot that has haunted me for 30 years about this movie. And it is the moment when Fran is in the
phone booth.
The phone booth, and we see Herb. And that effect and the heartbreak there, because they've done such a great job of setting up this kind of, you know,
apple pie romance between the two of them.
Yeah. This very September romance, you know, between these two people who work hard and have been friends for years and are both, you know, they both just kind of connect at the right moment. And to have that happen, and she's in this terrifying situation, she's about to die, and we don't know that Herb's dead.
Yeah.
And that is a shock to us.
Yeah. You only find out like early on, he goes, I'm going to go check out what's going on. And then you kind of forget about him.
No, you think he's going to come in and save her.
Yep.
Like, that's what works about that scene. Like, any moment Herb's going to show up and Herb's going to run off with her. And she's like, she's calling for Herb. And there he is in the blob. He's already dead. And the way his eye, he's got one of his eyes just kind of bouncing around as he's being slowly digested by the blob, just has haunted me for 30 years.
You know what's the most tragic about that is now their spinoff September romance movie has been canceled on Golden Blob. That's apparently never going to happen now.
Oh, Jesus. I love that I'm living the junk food cinema life right now. It's happening to me in analog time. I love this. Really, really?
The only thing you can't see is Cargill shooting daggers at me with his eyes.
Keep it going. Keep it going.
No. I'm sorry. I was just saying, hey, can we pause for a second so I can grab another beer?
No. You can go grab another beer because I'm gonna pontificate some more. So.
All right.
This is new for Cargill because someone else is doing the pontificating. So he's just like, cool, I'm going to go get a beer.
You know, the telephone death scene is one of those scenes that I remember going back, rewinding and rewatching over and over again. Because again, like I was saying before, there's three or four different disciplines at work in that. You know, you have very practical special effects. You have miniature special effects. You have stop motion effects. But the way that Darabont, and even in the script, on the script level, the way that he sets up just what Cargill was saying about the relationship between these two, that it's already so well defined that if they ended up being the protagonist, would have been fine with it.
Right.
They're that likable. But there's a really good example. You have that overhead shot, which is scary enough because you know they were smart enough to make this thing look like it was 3 day old fat from a like maybe 150 pound steak that's just like lingering over this poor girl.
Right.
And when you have that overhead shot, and then you cut to these other moments when you know the blob is about to come in, and it's getting the shots are getting short and the cuts are getting faster, but then it cuts to that brutal moment when the blob just basically forces its way in and destroys her. Yeah. Like that body is destroyed. But watch the editing of that, because the shot that comes before, when Candy Clark it's an overhead shot, it's looking down at her and she's screaming and yelling, and then it's broken up by two or three other, it cuts to that shot where the kind of blob wave comes in. The way that the editing is constructed, it makes you think that you actually are seeing the actress in that same shot that we've already established, and then it's clearly a miniature or a dummy or whatever. But I've seen the movie multiple times in theaters now. I was actually really cool. Like a couple of years ago at a film festival, I showed The Blob in the Syracuse International Film Festival, and you know that telephone scene was the scene that they showed in commercials. It was like, it was one of those just famous scenes from that they would always show, but they would never show that shot. And when that moment happened, I just, the glee I took at how the audience was so wrecked by that. And again, this is a character that had a total of maybe six pages of dialogue and action altogether, and you felt for her because of what they were constructing.
Well, it's what I call my Bloody Valentine effect, which is, you know, when I first moved to Austin and was starting out my critical career, it was the thing that taught me the difference between a good horror film in terms of character development, a bad horror film, was My Bloody Valentine, which is a movie about coal miners in Canada.
Which you, me, and Luke Mullen sat down and killed a six-pack with and watched it all together.
And I will do so again because it's amazing. But the thing is, I realized watching that movie, I was heartbroken when Ellis died.
Yeah.
Or Hollis, I'm sorry. Hollis died. Because they had done such a good job of making me like him. And despite the fact, again, I shouldn't give a shit about him because there's nothing about him that connects to my life experience. But they had done such a good job at developing him as a character that when he died, there was palpable effect on me. I felt that loss. And every single death, pretty much down to a T in The Blob, is the Hollis effect.
Well, I mean, and this is, and I want to get this, we've got a story to crank out of Joe, but
that's been very difficult so far.
Sorry.
First of all, you've got Chuck Russell, and then you've got Frank Darabont, and both of these have established themselves as filmmakers who know how to get you to care about people very quickly, and then fall in love with them, and then something tragic befalls them. I mean, this is why, you know, Darabont, you know, I mean, first of all, Darabont made one of the greatest movies ever made, which does that very well with Shawshank Redemption. You know, he does that very well in his later work. He especially, you know, he oversees that very well in The Walking Dead and helps kind of set the tone for that. And his work is really great. But Joe said you have a really great story about that.
Where do I begin? All right. Well, the blob story with, like, all right. God, I don't know which one I can tell. I became friends with Darabont because he saw a Wrong Turn 2 panel at the Weekend of Horrors. And he came up to me and said, like, hey, was that your movie that just played? And I knew exactly who he was. I was just like, Frank Darabont, blah, 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 blah. Like, and that conversation spawned his interest in, like, oh, wait, did Bear McCreary do the score for Wrong Turn 2?
Yes, he did.
And then that's where Bear ended up first doing an unfortunately booted version of the Myst score. And that's a whole nother story. But he also, that's kind of where he got hooked up to do The Walking Dead. So Frank and I became friends. And one night, Diablo Cody did, I almost said Juno Temple, totally different person.
Very different.
Diablo Cody did a whole week of programming at the New Beverly. And when one night, I think she was doing Nightmare 3 and The Blob. And in between, they had Frank and Chuck up there doing a kind of Q&A. And, you know, learned amazing tidbits. Like, I think they wrote the script for The Blob in 3 weeks. Like, they had to just basically sequester themselves to a hotel room at Palm Springs and just kind of like crank this thing out. And you sit there and you, all of the new, and then I love this new term that I learned from, but the amount of hidden guns in this movie is immense. And that's the sort of thing that comes, and Cargill, I'm sure you know this very well, but those are the sort of things that you connect the dots in draft 7 or 8. You marinate in the script for a little while before you start to really connect those dots in meaningful ways. And this script was written that short amount of time and has those many callbacks. Like, it's amazing what they were able to do. But so anyway, so if you've ever been to the New Beverly, they show really well curated trailers before each of the movies, very much like they do at the Draft House. So one of the trailers that they showed was Maximum Overdrive, one of the other movies that really fucked me up as a kid, showing kids. So if you recall the Maximum Overdrive trailer.
Now, is that the one where a cross-eyed stepdad tells me he's going to scare me to death?
Yes. Yes, the very one.
It's worse than that because of you guys know how much all three of us love Stephen King. But it's the one where he steps out and goes, you know, they say if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. And it's like, motherfucker, there are several directors who have done this shit right.
And somewhere you could hear John Carpenter, Brian De Palma, Stanley Kubrick screaming as Stephen King stepped on their dicks.
So, yeah. So, you know, he kind of puts this call to arms trailer out. And it was like the perfect audience for it. Everybody was hooting and hollering. And it just so happened that Frank and Chuck were sitting in front of me when the trailer was going on. And I do not know what fucking compelled me to say this, but at the end of that trailer, after Stephen King has basically said, like, hey, you got to do something. You want to do something right? You got to do it yourself. And I'm sitting in front of the man who's arguably made 3 of the best Stephen King adaptations ever. And the trailer ends and I go, top that, Darabont. And the place fucking erupts. And now what's even better is that Darabont turns around, looks me in the eye and goes, fuck you, Lynch. He's erupts in even bigger laughter. And I can say with all my heart that getting a fuck you from Frank Darabont is on my bucket list. Partially due to this movie.
Will the boys get away? Will they be consumed by the blob? How many beers will they drink? Find out next week on the exciting conclusion of Junk Food Cinema, The Blob, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.